I'm Brian Lyons. I'm an infrastructure architect with HP out of Cincinnati, Ohio. And this is Doug Hart.
I'm in Alliances Engineering. I've been working with VMware as a partner for the past 5 years.
So we're going to be talking about virtual desktop infrastructure. Initially, at the beginning, it's probably going to be some slides that a lot of you have seen before, just to kind of level set what virtual desktop infrastructure is, then get into some of the HP technologies and some of the management tools, and then Doug's going to get into some of the sizing, performance, and planning based on some testing we've done in a VDI infrastructure. So just initially, these are all desktop management challenges that all of IT has been dealing with since we've been buying desktops. They're remote locations with little IT skills, distributed workforce, complex management. These are all issues that traditionally we've addressed with best practices and limiting the number and variance of PCs that we would buy and SMS and application delivery tools. Even though with everyone's best efforts, it still has become a very complex, difficult task. Again, just some additional issues. The security threats and the compliance are probably some newer issues piled on top of all the traditional issues we've been dealing with Sarbanes-Oxley and HIPAA, and with the security threats. You know, we've all seen the well-publicized issues of data being lost on laptops and all that information. So because of these issues, we've had some needs for some new capabilities, the ability for a more rapid or instant desktop recovery and provisioning, the ability to provide for alternative workspaces, through the outsourcing, the ability to provide a reliable, workable platform for our outsourced partners to utilize without sacrificing security and moving the data outside of the data center, and the need for desktop consolidation and standardization where we pull that data inside a secure data center in a centralized fashion. So some keys to addressing these challenges is obviously centralizing the computing resources, taking that data and installing on all those access devices and pulling them back in-house, increasing the standardization. This is something that was extremely difficult to accomplish in a physical environment, in a virtual world. Since that hardware is virtualized, that guest OS, I mean, it looks like it's running on the same hardware, whether that's, you know, a two-way server, four-way, even down to, you know, running it on my laptop or another device. Streamlining the management, centralizing those hardware management tasks for deploying the desktops and everything involved with the management, and increasing the flexibility. And these are some features that are just inherent to running your desktops on virtual infrastructure. You then bring in the ability for the high availability modules, the DRS capabilities, so you can do your load balancing, and then also your, you know, consolidated backups. So these are all things that all of us have kind of adopted for our server infrastructure. In a VDI infrastructure, you can leverage those things for your desktops as well. So really, what is this virtual desktop infrastructure? It's pretty basic. It's basically you're hosting your desktop operating system in a virtual machine using some type of remote display protocol to get to that desktop image. And that remote display protocol, I don't know if some of you folks maybe have been in the Collier County presentation before this one. For the most part, it's been Microsoft's RDP protocol. There is some ability to do ICA, and that is something that's under development. If you've got Linux desktops, you're looking at something like VNC. And in Collier County's instance, they used HP's remote graphics software. So the benefits of this virtual desktop infrastructure is it improved manageability, centralizing the resources, increasing the standardization, increasing the flexibility, just the different options you have for the backing up, for load balancing, for deployment. There's a whole lot of flexibility that's brought to bear. So how does it all work? You've got your virtual infrastructure inside your secure data center. So you've got ESX with VI3, and those models could be, you know, DRS enabled. The full feature would be HA enabled, DRS enabled. Desktop images being saved on a SAN. So your desktops, your thin clients connect using some remote display protocol. And then they connect to one of the virtual machines using that remote display protocol. So business use cases, these have been some of the most common instances where we've been seeing the early adopters of virtual desktop infrastructure. The outsourcing and offshoring, that includes call centers and developers. Desktop consolidation, again, this really falls into the call center realm as well. For disaster recovery, for being able to provide the ability to have a continuous access to your desktops in the event of a disaster, and alternative workspaces, trying to plan for, you know, the classic example is the bird flu, to where a user is not going to be able to come to the office. You know, they're talking a period of 2 to 3 months where they, your users may have to work from alternative places. So through the use of VDI, they'd have a consistent work environment, whether they're in the office or at a remote location. And again, this is a drill down on those examples. So for your developer communities, and I think there's, for your developer communities, this is a lot of times your developers, they need to have the ability to reboot the box. A lot of them want to take, they may need or want, you know, 3, 4, 5 different desktops that they could do some testing on, have different iterations of the code, be able to reboot the box, trash the box. VDI provides the flexibility that you could do those kinds of things where, you know, it's a little bit more heartburn if you have a developer saying, oh, you know, let me have 4 or 5 boxes that they have stacked under their desk with a KVM, and it just becomes a much easier to provide them that flexibility to help them do their job better without jumping through all kinds of hoops. For the branch office consolidation, this is an area where we've seen kind of a opportunity to do a mixed deployment. So you could do it solely for your branch office, where if you just want to provide a thin device coming back to the centralized data center, kind of a variation on that. We've seen some customers with manufacturing sites. We've got multiple manufacturing sites, and at each site there's 3 or 4 different servers, a few apps running on Windows XP that run part of the manufacturing process, and the admin desktops for the folks that work in the office. We could take those boxes, drop in a couple of ESX servers with an entry-level SAN like our MSA product, and we could run those server images in there, run the desktop images on there, make it highly available, provide HA for the whole thing, and that becomes a real nice contained solution at a remote site that as IT personnel is a lot easier to deploy and manage that as well. Some of the advantages brought to bear in a disaster recovery environment is you've got your centralized data center, all the images stored on a SAN. We could replicate that SAN to your DR site. And then in the event that your primary data center fails, we could then have those virtual machines brought up at the DR site on existing ESX servers over there. They don't have to be the same type. It's a lot simpler way to do DR. And again, these are all things that we've done in our server environments as well. And then we can restore access and go back to our normal operation. So just looking at all the various components of a complete VDI solution, at the bottom layer, you obviously have the physical layer, which we list ProLiant servers and blades. And Doug's going to get into some of the different physical options. One thing I'd just like to mention here is a lot of customers do ask, well, do I go with a rack, traditional rack mount server or a blade server? It doesn't come down to a matter of, it's not a workload question. It's not a capacity question. It's really just an I/O requirement question. And can I get enough NIC ports and enough SAN ports in order to do what I need to do? So that was traditionally the decision point. In our P class, you can go with 4 1-gig NICs with 2 SAN connections, which for a lot of times was enough. We had some customers say, I really would like 6. With the C class product, we can get a half height blade, 6 NIC connections, 2 fiber connections, and the full height full socket blade, you're looking at 10 NIC connections and 4 SAN connections. So that really kind of, you know, opens the door that there's not a whole lot of applications where you're going to be configuring more than that in your rack mount server. So then once beyond that, we obviously have the virtualization layer up through the connection brokers, which I'm going to drill down on, your remote access protocol, which we've touched on a lot, and then your client hardware, which is your desktops, thin clients, etc. So as far as managing this whole stack, HP Systems Insight Manager has touch points at all levels of the stack, which I'm going to drill down a little bit on that as well. And also the remote deployment pack. A lot of people either look at the remote deployment pack and say, well, it either fits in at the client level or it fits in down at the server level. It really covers that whole stack, because at the server level, I could do a bare metal deployment of ESX. And as you move up the stack, I could run the script on the ESX server to create a new VM, build a new VMDK file, provision that new virtual machine, boot it up, it'll pixie boot, hit my RDP server, and then I could deploy my base desktop image to it as well. So that's why I've got the rapid deployment pack covering that whole side of the stack as well. So now, just to drill down a little further on managing a VDI solution. So with Systems Insight Manager combined with the Virtual Machine Manager, Virtual Machine Manager is a plug-in for SIM that's specifically for your virtualized environments. It supports ESX, GSX, Virtual Server, Microsoft Virtual Server, Xen. But really what the goal for us to do is that you could have one location to where I can get the status of my VMs, I could see what host my VMs are running on, I could launch a remote desktop to my VMs, stop them, start them, pause them, back them up, migrate them, down to I could see the physical server, I could see what the, if I've got a memory module problem in there, it's exceeded the acceptable amount of single bit memory errors or disk errors, etc. So you could, from one tool, be able to get notifications and have visibility of that whole stack instead of bouncing around through a couple different tools. And that's really our goal with that. It's not a lot of people ask, well, are you trying to compete with Virtual Center, with VMM? It's like, well, we're not. But we're providing the ability that you could have that whole stack, get notifications on that whole stack, and have an overall view using that one tool. And then there's some things you may need to go to Virtual Center to do, or another tool that you have to do. But you could at least be notified and take appropriate action if it's an action you can't take from that main console. The server migration pack. Server migration pack is a tool that does P2V, or physical to virtual migration, V2V, so you can move between the different virtualization technologies that we support, primarily the Microsoft and the VMware, and V2P, which is virtual to ProLiant. This provides a nice opportunity if you've got, a lot of times when you're going to virtualization, you get pushback from the business unit. If you have SMP, you can provide some assurance other than saying, well, if this doesn't work, we'll get it back. You could say, listen, if it doesn't work or you're unhappy with the performance in a virtualized environment, we've got a tool in place that we can move it back onto a ProLiant server and to provide some assurances to those business units or those groups in your organization that might be giving some pushback on moving towards virtualization. The rapid deployment pack, I think we covered that pretty well. We do the bare metal ESX install all the way up to creating the VMs and even deploying the desktop images as well. Vulnerability and patch management, that uses our Radia patch engine to do security scans to look for vulnerabilities and also fix those vulnerabilities in addition to applying patches and hot fixes. So there's two basic VDI implementations. You could do a static implementation to where every end device connects to a specific virtual machine. They connect either by, IP address. The IP address could be hard-coded down to the physical device or by that virtual machine name. So far, that has been the most common implementation of doing VDI. We have seen lots of momentum growing in doing the dynamic model. The dynamic model uses a connection broker or a portal or whatever terminology you want to use. We've been calling it a connection broker. So through the use of the connection broker, the connection requests go to the connection broker. The connection broker connects that end device to a virtual machine in a pool. When that user disconnects, that virtual machine is returned back into the pool. Just to cover the basic functions of how a connection broker works, there's multiple connection brokers available, and they all have this similar kind of function. So first, the client sends a connection request to the broker. A lot of times this is either done through a client app or through a web app through accessing a portal, but the client places the request. The connection broker validates the username and also checks to see what role, group, whatever one of the other terms you'd want to use to determine what pools are available for that end user to connect to. So, for example, if we're using this for a developer, I may allow a developer to either hit a developer pool, which you could then statically map them to specific VMs in the developer pool, and then just have them hit the production pool. So if they want to do their development activities, they connect to a development box. If they want to do like email and stuff like that, they may want to connect to a production image. So you could provide access to multiple pools. And most of the connection brokers, it checks to see what pools are available for that user to see, provides back a list, and then the user clicks on which pool they want to connect to, and then it makes the connection. So then the connection broker provides an RDP connection to an available VM in the pool, and the client then makes the connection to that virtual machine. The virtual machine then updates the connection broker of what its status. It's obviously no longer available, logged in. And this is done either two different ways. There's either some type of service running on the VM that talks to the connection broker, or the connection broker is doing a periodic poll to see what the status of that box is. Some different examples. We're going to go through an example of using the Citrix connection broker. There's also Prepero, LeoStream, and Dunes. There's other ones out there. A lot of them are out on the exhibit floor, so I'd encourage you to talk to them to learn the different features of their products. They all provide unique advantages and disadvantages. So we're going to go through in the Citrix access infrastructure kind of as an example. So this is your traditional presentation server environment with VDI inserted. So we've got our access gateway, our published apps from presentation server, and then we add in our virtual machine clients on our virtual infrastructure. So the end user system establishes an external connection. That'd have to be an external connection, but they just want to show going through the access gateway. And then the remote desktop connection is published for that user. Then they launch that remote desktop connect, that published app, which is really remote desktop, that connects them to a specific remote desktop image. Then that the RDP client renders that image on the end user device. So when you add the connection broker, from an access standpoint, it doesn't change, but that image manager connects them to an available machine in that pool. And when the user logs off, that virtual machine is then released and freed up to that pool. So through Prepero, I mean, one of the things with Citrix and Prepero one of the advantages was it provides the a built-in remote user connection through an SSL VPN. The other two I'm going to mention, the LeoStream and the Dunes products, don't handle the remote access, so you need to have your own remote access solution. But they do a nice job of pulling the VMs, integrating with Active Directory, also providing some unique features like the ability to do some self-provisioning, having some workflow that you could approve provisioning requests and et cetera. So now Doug's going to come up and talk about some of the testing we've done and get into sizing and...
Thanks, Brent. I think what it said, that's pretty bad. So I think Brian kind of covered the why they would do it and how do you generally go about doing it. And I think what I'm going to talk about is more of the you've decided to do it. Now, how do I size it? How do I configure it? And then how do I push it out? And what results can I expect? From a sizing standpoint, I'm going to cover things like accounting for the number of users on the system, some limitations around disk and storage controllers, memory resources, talk about network sizing and latency, and then go into sizing this thing as it regards tolerance for risk. So the first thing to cover as you're sizing a system like this is kind of the number and type of users. You've got one of two options, really. If you organize your users by business unit or user type. So what I mean by that is if you have, you're going to configure your environment and set your VMs, your pools by business unit, chances are you're going to have very similar type of user that's using the VMs within that particular pool. If you do it by user type, you may get similar users with different characteristics and behaviors. That definitely affects how you size and choose. Business unit organization, also, if you're going to be doing sizing to test and figure out what loads you want to put on there, probably requires a lot more work. Other thing to consider as you're putting users into a system like this is what are the users actually doing in terms of work? If you have call centers, which is a frequent example that comes up for this and may or may not, depending on situation, be ideal, but a call center user, if they're sitting down by the phone, they're very often working. So this is a person that may work 55 minutes out of every hour. They may be actually plugging data into the computer. That's a pretty good stream of I.O. coming back and forth. On the flip side, you get people like me who like to sit back and read in the office and stuff, and, well, I might be on there 10 minutes in an hour. So, the variety is there. From a system standpoint, the disk and storage controllers are the primary thing to sizing. During logon periods especially, there's a very large impact on user response times. And I will talk about user response times, but when I say that, what I mean is the amount of time from when a user goes ahead and says, I want to do this, whether mouse, keyboard input, whatever it happens to be, to when the response that they expect comes back to them. Pretty simple. Click on the Word icon, Word comes up. That's the response time. From a disk and storage controller standpoint as well, there's probably a need to balance redundancy requirements with performance requirements. Always better to divide storage requests between two or more storage controllers in this environment. So if you've got 100 users that you want to put into this system, from a performance standpoint, the best results would always be user one enters here, goes off to this line, user two enters here, goes off to this line. And then external direct attached storage controllers should be maximized for onboard cache. From the memory resources, the message I think is overcommit memory. Works exceedingly well with the SX3. Matching up by user type, which I kind of covered on that first slide, has a pretty good effect on this. If you have users that are utilizing the same programs over and over again, VMware does an excellent job of handling memory. Also, if you organize the business unit, you kind of want to balance the cost of additional memory with the importance of the work being done. What I mean by that is if you have mission-critical workers and you're going to put them in a pool, it's probably worthwhile to invest a little bit more memory on that physical system. But if you have data entry workers that aren't necessarily doing mission-critical work and can handle maybe a little bit of a higher response time and you're more comfortable with a little bit greater memory overcommitment, the investment may not justify itself. Network size and latency, now this is kind of a key issue as well, and there's four key areas for it. First is redirection of user data. Brian mentioned dynamic models, which are becoming more and more common. In that particular instance, at logon time, the user's data is connected to them and their environment is personalized. All that feeds over the network. Printing requirements, pretty big deal. Local device redirection, which is kind of a follow-on to printing, among other things. And then remote desktop protocol. So from a redirection of user data standpoint. Again, primarily used in a brokered model, but it can really put some heavy traffic on the network at logon. This is something where the consideration of separate physical adapters and virtual switches can be recommended. So what we're trying to do here is keep the user data traffic separate from the remote protocol and printing traffic. Leaves the pipe open and it doesn't interfere with the screen being presented to the user. From a printing standpoint, separate from other traffic when possible. It could be tied to the same network as remote protocol traffic, and I say could. If you're in an environment where you're not allowing device redirection from the client, it's probably pretty good. It's a pretty wide open pipeline and gives you some control over where you print to. And it's definitely the favored form. If you want to use network printing, or if you're going to allow printing, network is the way to go. Local devices are not, which is kind of the next thing I'll talk about. If my screen will change, there it goes. So local device redirection, don't do it, and don't do it. But if you must do it, I'll tell you why, actually. So the reason not to do it is it places an extra burden on the network. And in this case, most of the time, the remote desktop protocol is actually what is carrying the redirected data back and forth. So you're sharing this network with the screen traffic. The other thing that it does is it kind of retains the need for desk side support. If you're going to let users set a printer on their desktop, if you're going to let users set a or bring a USB key with them, you've got issues of data portability to deal with, and you've got another device sitting on the desktop that's prone to failure. And part of the point of doing this, or one of the best, I shouldn't say part of the point, one of the best things about doing this is that at the end of the day, your support costs should go down because you're, again, trying to implement devices out on the desk side that really don't need to be supported. If you have to do it, again, traffic's carried over the connection protocol, and it's a good idea to do as much as possible to limit the device types to what you're comfortable supporting. For the most part, that seems to mean printers. If you're comfortable supporting USB keys, great. But again, we're getting back to data portability. One of the key advantages of this entire solution, I think we've all read in the newspaper over and over again, somebody lost a laptop and they're buying a whole lot of support for their users on the credit report sites because their private information got lost. This cuts a lot of that out. Remote protocols, just a quick comment on these, and again, Microsoft RDP seems to be the preferred protocol and the most common protocol. This is more sensitive, as a rule, to latency than it is to absolute bandwidth. This can easily be done over a 100 megabit network. We've done some testing in the distant past that even suggested maybe a 10 megabit network. The trick is low latency. If you're much above 60 milliseconds, your user experience starts to shift a little bit. And again, this one in particular can be affected by device redirection. The final thing in implementing this and deciding what you want is the tolerance for risk. So remember, in this environment, and it's like all virtual machine environments, I think most people in here probably are familiar with VMware, so there's a certain level of risk. You're putting a certain number of eggs in one basket, if you will. So in a VDI environment, a system level failure can mean some downtime for a greater number of users. The more sockets that are on the system, the greater that risk becomes. The latest two socket systems we're finding are not fully utilized with even 128 light users. With VMware, you cannot start the 129th virtual machine. And when I say light users, people who are doing web browsing, maybe doing some light data entry, more kiosk-style workers. But it's quite possible to keep them working continuously, and 128 VMs, there's still room left over. On a four-socket system, the overhead would probably look pretty ridiculous. The other thing, too, is, again, just it's important to define your tolerance for risk. Anything low and medium of two-socket system is more than sufficient in this environment. Keep in mind, in a Windows XP virtual machine, you can only have a single virtual processor. So going to a four-socket system is not going to gain you a lot. A high tolerance, you could probably go with a four-socket system, and potentially with a high tolerance for risk, maybe even mix other applications into the environment. As a general recommendation to reduce your risk, including heavy users on each system and spreading out their load, which tends to bring up the overall system utilization load, is probably a recommended, it's a good practice. So what is the performance? Well, what we did was we tested the DL380 G5 using a tireless worker. The DL380 G5 is a new server. I'll discuss the system configuration in a second. And when we say tireless worker, this is based on Microsoft's TS scaling script for knowledge workers. If you're not familiar with that, this is essentially a worker that runs Outlook, attaches something, sends an email, types data into Word, saves document, browses to a web page, opens up Excel, enters some data, saves that document off, and does this in a continuous fashion over and over and over again until you stop the process. We enhanced that a little bit. One of the things we did was we used real-time virus scanning inside the virtual machines to increase the load a little bit, and also to echo the fact that, is there anybody in this room that doesn't have a virus scanner on their local machine? And is it connected to the internet if you raise your hand? So we thought that would probably be pretty advisable to do. We defined our bottlenecks a couple different ways. first was what we call based on user inputs. And what this means is we were looking at user response times. Remember, we said, click Word, when does Word come up? There were two definitions we found, and so we kind of decided to go with both of them. Definition for 200 milliseconds is a Gartner-based industry definition of what a snappy response time that a user really wouldn't notice is. 200 milliseconds, it's an eye blink. The other one, 150 milliseconds, was based on a human factors research study that has been going on for quite a while, and we decided, okay, let's just say 99% of our user response times below 200 milliseconds, 98% below 150 milliseconds. Meaning that for the most part, say users clicking along all day long, they never notice a thing. We want snappy response times. From a system utilization standpoint, we said, okay, there's some other good things that I think we're all used to. Anytime you see a benchmark, for the most part, they say, if I cap 80% CPU utilization, that system is flooded. Not many people want to run greater than 80% in production. Understandable. In this particular instance, too, because we were overcommitting memory, we decided that on average it had to be 2 gigabytes, at least 2 gigabytes of free non-console memory available to the virtual machines. And it turned out that the other subsystems did not really factor into the equation when we were doing our testing. Now, the system itself, I think that's what's next. Yep. Again, it was a ProLiant DL380 G5. It had two 2.66 gigahertz Intel Xeon 5150 processors. These are not the absolute fastest, but they are the next to the top of the line Intel processors. They're 16 gig of PC2 5300 megahertz memory. And two SmartArray P600 controllers with 256 mega cache, each connected to a separate MSA50 disk enclosure that had 10,000 RPM drives in it. That's where the VMs were stored, and that's where the user data was stored. From a network standpoint, again, we just used the two onboard NICs. We bound them together into a single virtual switch that was shared between the console and the virtual machines. That's kind of our test environment from a physical standpoint. From a VM standpoint, we had a Windows XP desktop, 512 meg of memory, Windows XP Service Pack 2, 10 gig virtual hard disk drive. The user data was local. Put a single virtual processor in and a single virtual network card. That was for the test. And our results were pretty amazing. One of the things that we've seen, we've had customers that have done this for a while, and every successive generation of processor that comes out brings, of course, a successive increase in the number of users per system. We have, between VMware ESX Server 3 and the latest generation processors and the front side buses increasing in speed, memory increasing in speed, seen quite a leap in performance. And what we saw was, based on user response times, the 200 millisecond and 150 millisecond response times that we defined, 80 to 85 concurrent users in this environment is acceptable. We're running at about 61 to 62% processor in that environment. So the system is still slightly underutilized. If we allow those response times to drop down a little bit into the 97% range instead of 98, 100 to 105 concurrent users eventually pushes the CPU up to 78 to 80% under full utilization. Pretty impressive. That's a lot of data coming across the system, and the nice part about it is, as all of those systems are running, and you can actually come up to the show floor today or tomorrow, we'll have workload running on a bunch of virtual machines. You can come up and you get a VM that just responds. I'll point out, too, if you've used these email stations at all, those are all running off of a single server. Every virtual desktop that you connect to is off of one server and servicing the entire show with printing, network browsing, people getting their email, grabbing attachments, whatever they have to do. And we are seeing very low utilization with that. It's pretty impressive stuff. Things we learned, there's near linear processor scalability. VMware did a paper on this a little while ago as well with a prior generation system, and they saw the same thing. We saw better than expected memory management, and I think that was probably a little bit of a non-surprise to people that have watched VMware grow over time. It's pretty incredible memory management, actually. We found the storage controllers are extremely important, and again, if you do direct attach in any way, more cache is better. And the user experience remains outstanding across the board. Something that For the Doubting Thomases we have run across, we're more than happy to start up 60 or 70 of them doing work and let them walk up and see what they think. It works wonderfully. And with that, I think really we're opening for question and answers. Yes.
PSX remote control portion, because it seems like all of the things I've seen have all used some sort of software running either in the OS or at the OS level, guest OS level. Is there nothing that ties into the actual virtual infrastructure layer?
There's not, and you wouldn't want to.
I don't know if this thing's on, yeah.
So,
what was the question first?
The question was, is there anything we could use that would utilize the VMware remote control application? And there isn't, and you really wouldn't want your end users connecting to your VMs over that mechanism, because for one, that's using your console network. And typically, you don't even want to give your users access to your console network. And two, all the graphics and KVM actions in that remote client occur within the console OS. So that immediately becomes a bottleneck as you have multiple people hitting that. Even though the performance of the VM is still good, it'll look terrible from the end user perspective because it's just taking that little slice of that console OS, and that's where all those KVM resources are coming out of. So that thing's just for a admin access only.
Yes, sir.
Any thoughts on using or why we wouldn't want to use the dynamic resource scheduling or the dynamic failover modules in 3 for this environment? Auto provision or auto plan?
So
go with failover.
Okay. So the question was, any thoughts around why we would or wouldn't use DRS or HA in this environment? And I think the answer to both is, for the most part, I think DRS and HA are in a position right now, much like vMotion was a couple years ago, where the adoption level is maybe down here and starting to curve. I think you'll probably see more adoption as time goes on. We have done minor testing with HA in this environment, and it recovers fine. I have not attempted in-depth DRS testing yet, but I see no reason, since these are just virtual machines behaving much like if they were running Linux or Windows 2003 or Windows NT.
And the customers I've worked on this, the VI3 customers, they've used HA right off the bat.
Yes, and that makes sense.
I'm trying to vMotion 100 users off one.
Well, HA doesn't do vMotion. Yeah.
From a vMotion, you brought up vMotion, and that's a great question. We want to take a note down for maintenance. Can you do that? I'm just not sure.
So we, at one customer, we were vMotioning 45. We did that exact test to see. We did 45 machines all vMotioned at the same time, and that took 6 seconds. Yeah, so it was...
It becomes a matter, too, though, just keep in mind for a scenario like that where you have that, is make sure you have a separate VM kernel network.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I'll make the point for the people in the room that may not be there. But, yes.
What would be your minimal network requirements for setting something? I mean, can you get into 10 megabit frame relay, 100 megabit?
So this is an interesting scenario because technically you have networks going off in different directions. The network to the end user, an existing 100 megabit infrastructure for most circumstances would probably adequately handle that traffic. In fact,
I think you want to have about 30K per user at the end of that.
Yeah.
Thing.
So, you know, given your multiplier, the size of your office, that's probably more than adequate. To get back in the data center, I think the gigabit just becomes almost a default back there, simply because the NICs on the servers anymore are all gigabit. Most of the infrastructure is that way as well. User data redirection is probably your heaviest traffic item in this if you're doing a dynamic environment. The wider pipe you give them, obviously, the better it performs.
What about streaming video? Streaming video.
So streaming video, and this is much like streaming video over any remote desktop protocol connection. It's not something where you want to do high-end graphics applications and heavy streaming video.
And that's where... So the session before us was with Collier County, and that was... They used educational applications, and streaming video and audio was a core requirement for them. They ended up using HP's remote graphics RGS protocol in order to do that. And that works quite well for them. They've got 40,000 virtual machines deployed. What was the question? Yes, they're using, so HP has a couple of different products to address those challenges we talked about up front. We've got Blade PCs and our consolidated client infrastructure. We also have Blade workstations, Blade professional workstations for traders, for your high-end graphics developers. So in order for that, to use that professional workstation Blade, we needed to be able to provide the high-end graphics and multiple monitor support. So we developed a protocol called RGS, or Remote Graphics Software.
RGS is not supported in this environment, has not been tested.
Collier County is running it in customers are doing it, but we're not telling you to do it.
I had a hand up at the same time on the last question.
So how does VDI, what are the different advantages to VDI over just terminal services, just a pool of terminal service?
I think the advantage moves to the fact that it's a virtual machine. You've got the ability to rapidly create these. The question was around what are the advantages to doing this with VDI instead of just, say, a regular terminal services environment. From a functional standpoint, if you're serving up a desktop from terminal services, you're using a single Microsoft system to provide numerous desktop. And so you're doing a level of system sharing for certain parts of that desktop. In this, you are actually partitioning off each of these virtual machines, and they do not have any direct access unless you give them direct access to each other. So that's one particular advantage. The other is that in this environment, one thing that you see with VMware from a performance standpoint is you see memory aggregation. And so similar processes in memory that are occurring can be aggregated quite nicely. And in fact, they do an outstanding job with it. So your memory utilization is a little bit better. And then the ability that you get simply from virtualization in general, I can deploy these things very rapidly. I can have complete administrative control over them remotely without having to rely on a network that is external to the user.
The biggest ones are isolation. So each instance
absolutely.
Is isolated. So in the instance of a developer, their VM, they can reboot it, they can shut it down.
Do whatever they want to it.
In a TS environment, that server goes down, any user that connects to that box is down. When you update an application, there's a lot of compatibility issues that the people that have been using TermServe know that when you're doing an upgrade, it's like, hope nothing else gets broken in that process. So all those issues are go away, and primarily it's the compatibility where... a lot of the big implementations I've done have been, the reason they're doing this is because the applications they're running, they have compatibility problems with running it in a term server environment.
What's the largest implementation you've seen with remote users at a site and using a LAN connection back to all the VDIs, and how do they address the bandwidth issues?
I've got a customer right now that where the user population's about 10,000. Now the local access, the relatively even the stateside access is pretty good. They have some users out of country they're trying to provide access to, and it's just been a challenge.
So if I have a couple hundred users, what
should I expect for bandwidth requirements for that?
I'd figure I would try and provide, say, 30K a user.
Uncompressed. Is
yeah.
Any way to optimize that?
What was
quality of service?
Yeah, I did have I had one customer that was doing a pilot, and they were using a WAN accelerator.
Riverbed.
Yeah, and they were saying that was help, that
so
helped as well.
Okay, user, a couple hundred users, that's pretty starting to get pretty expensive. PLS implementation.
Yeah, I mean, if you got a remote site with a couple hundred users, yeah.
Sort of a follow-up to that question. We're doing this with the outsourced developers in Malaysia, coming back to the U.S., and we're using the public internet to bring the connection. We're using SSL VPN to establish good connection. Most of our problems have been with the SSL VPN failures and problems. Do you have any thoughts on addressing that issue?
I mean, it all comes down to your SSL VPN provider. I mean, it's, you know, I've heard some good things about, you know, like the MobiKey, where it's all the codes contained on the key, you know, and I hope HP, our remote solution is, we got thousands of us in the field. We're not doing, you know, we're using it for remote connections, running everything on our laptops in a traditional mode, but we still do a lot of RDP access over that for demos, and I know I quite frequently do. I don't know, it's sketchy. If I had to rely on it, you know, 40-hour, you know, 9 to 5 every single day, I don't know if I have a good answer for you. You know, it's... Oh yeah.
You lose your virtual desktop.
You don't lose your session. So if I was in the middle of Word, and I'm writing a document or an email or something, and I lose my connection, when I reconnect, I'll reconnect back to that same session, and it'll be back where it was when I got disconnected.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, on the back wall. In a CAD environment? No, we haven't. Again, I think CAD is one of the applications that would probably be pretty close to the top of the list of something you don't want to deliver across this with standard desktop protocols today. Yes?
Mine's a good follow-up to that one. At what level of either compute, disk, or graphics needs do you start cutting things off? Because I know these compute things. What would your...
So, wait, you want to take that?
Yeah. If you need multiple processors, it's pretty obvious you're going to be outside of VDI.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from an HP standpoint, we think we've got the widest range of products to meet those needs. I'd tell you to look at our professional workstation blade, which uses the same methodologies, but you use RGS, which you can do your AutoCAD, you can do your high-end graphics, anything you needed to do from that standpoint, you could do with RGS using the same methodologies, getting the same benefits that you would from a VDI implementation. So first off, you need multiple procs. That eliminates it right there.
Depends on what your access device is on the other end as well. If you have certain users that you want to provide the majority of their experience with a remote desktop for a management point, okay, but say you have localized desktop applications that can run, it's always a possibility. The remote device becomes a little easier to support, especially if it's only one or two specialized applications running on it. The other thing, too, is if you're talking about things like users that would frequently access streaming video, it's quite possible to push that directly to a thin client, let the thin client handle the streaming video portion of it. So there's not a great rule of thumb around it. It's just a matter of... user definitions, which I think we all, if anybody in here does desktop stuff, knows is not always the easiest thing to get a handle on. But there's so much flexibility that there's just not one certain point where you go, that's it, that's where we cut off.
What's your question?
So the question is the difference between this and the CCI methodology in terms of connection?
Just dependent usage. Dependent usage.
So I think...
So with CCI, instead of connecting to an individual blade, or connecting to a virtual machine, you connect to a blade. So we've got a 3U chassis that holds 20 blade PCs. Each one of those blade PCs is running Windows XP, and you connect to it through RDP, just like you would connecting to your virtual machine. Really, it's up to it's really the customer's choice, because they're both designed to meet the same set of objectives. Now, if I have customers that have not adopted VMware for the server infrastructure and VMware's brand new to them, and you're talking to them about it, and they're like, one, we're not comfortable with ESX, and we've got to bring in the SAN, we've got all this other stuff to do, those customers tend to go towards CCI. But if we have the customers that have a big server implementation on VMware and maybe even have sparingly dropped some XP machines on there, they'll say, hey, let's just deploy some XP on VMware for a user community.
Did you? Okay. I kept seeing you raise your hand. I just want to make sure. Okay.
I have a question. We're looking at doing a VDI for a customer credit card application. Our unit wants to keep the application, and we're thinking about the VDI. But the only way that we can think of securing the desktop back, for keystroke logging, that kind of thing, would be to like a live terminal or something like that. Do you know of any tools inside, an OS, like a Windows OS desktop that would allow that remote desktop window to itself somehow be secure, so that it wouldn't be victim of keystroke logging and that kind of thing? Say you were typing a credit card information through to the back end secure desktop.
I'd have to research a little bit more, but if you tied it down to just doing... just allowing you maybe access to a browser and then doing the RDP connection in a browser.
Yeah. Today it's a typical desktop with Outlook and Exchange, that kind of thing.
Yeah, not off the top of my head. I mean, it's...
There's obviously a level of protection there in that you can encrypt the traffic between using the connection protocol. Going into the back end, too, a virtual machine, of course, is much harder to load data into than is a physical desktop. So in terms of a keystroke logger, it would probably be far more difficult to get one installed into a virtual machine in the background than it would be onto a physical desktop. There's no physical access for anybody to be able to do it, and they're far easier. I won't say far easier. It's just as easy to lock one down as it is to lock down a desktop. They remain more functional when you lock them down, since the user is not accessing them directly and needing to physically manipulate them.
If I already have an existing VI3 infrastructure with servers, my management station, and all that, the VI3 servers, if I want to do VDI, does that just roll up in the same way, or does that have to have its own separate management kind of system and all that?
So the management infrastructure for VDI is much the same as it is.
Create a new VM.
It's the same as my servers and my desktop.
Yeah.
Yes.
Create my pools, create my clusters.
And even most patch management solutions that will handle server-side Windows operating systems will also handle desktop-side operating systems.
Oh, and I'm sorry. I forgot to mention, it's Lisa, right? Lisa's in the back. She was looking for beta people that wanted to be beta customers for ACE2. So if you're interested in that, see Lisa in the back.
Quick question. Have you guys tested with Vista at all? Just so that we can future-proof our server and the scalability changes radically.
I've run Vista in one. I haven't had a customer do, run 50 of them or something, but me personally, yeah, I've run Vista in a VM.
Okay.
just really to play with Vista, not necessarily test.
I think that question, too, before we can adequately answer it, Vista has to be a little farther along than it is as
well.
You mentioned controllers, more the better.
Yes.
Well, that's the case of DAS. What about the case of a SAN, say, iSCSI? You know, the two NICs teamed together from iSCSI core, do the same rules apply, or is that a different set of...
So I would tend to... We have not tested the iSCSI yet. My initial thought would be yes. Yeah. The wider the data path and the more options you have in terms of data paths, the better off you're going to be. Rarely does
but I don't know if I would host my VMFS over iSCSI for this.
Really?
For this implementation.
Well, so, yes, and that's definitely for the most part, but you can also start thinking in terms of how you delegate or divide up your users in this environment. If you have users that aren't doing mission critical data, there's been a lot of discussion that why do I buy mission critical storage to hold their data? And vice versa, if I've got users whose data is incredibly important, why am I putting them down on a small SAN instead of on something that is replicatable? So I think that it's a preference issue to a certain extent. And from an iSCSI standpoint, if you have lower-end users that